Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross with you once again, talking about what's going on this week. And Rob Ross, I think what's been going on across New York and across the most of the Midwest has been just absolute brutal heat and humidity. What an awful summer this has been so far.
We are on, I think, our third official heat wave, according to the National Weather Service, certainly in New York. We had temperatures starting in the morning at around 85, 86 degrees.
Yep.
Between Tuesday through yesterday, it reached a point of 100 degrees on Thursday. Just this sweltering, and most days, that oppressive heat that just leaves you going, let me stay indoors and not go out for any reason. Now, unfortunately, when you have to go to work and you have to walk to and from public transportation, it's bad enough. When you have to take public transportation, it's even worse.
Right, yeah, because then you're there with everybody else who's been out in that heat. And here it's been right about the same. We had 4 days this week where we were over 100. We hit 103, and I think that was the high point. And it's just been unbreakable. Supposedly, the remainder of the day and into tomorrow is going to be a little bit better, so we're keeping fingers crossed. But in the meantime, like you said, a lot of staying inside, a lot of staying in the air conditioning.
Well, I'll tell you what. Today here in New York, it is just disgustingly muggy and humid. You know, it's seeping into the house, and we've got the air conditioners on, and that's doing very little to help, because you don't want to run the air conditioner all day and all night.
Right.
You do want to have a break from it, but the minute you turn it off, in comes the heat. It's just it's really uncomfortable. But I think I want to start the show off on a different note than we usually would, because to quote Gary Cohen, the night that Johan Santana pitched the first no-hitter in the history of the New York Mets, June 1st, 2012, I'm going to apply it to our show. The impossible has happened. You and I finally have an issue. You and I are about to clash.
And I know exactly what you're talking about, because I posted a picture on Facebook just a little while ago. I was walking through the Walgreens, through the candy aisle, and what do I see? And I didn't even see it. My wife pointed it out to me, and she said, what abomination is that? And it was a white chocolate Reese's peanut butter cup.
Now I got a quote from Randall Graves, bunch of savages. How dare you? How dare you say such horrific and untoward things about the beauty, the glory, the God-given gift that is white chocolate. A white chocolate Reese's peanut butter cup and its companion piece, the white chocolate Kit Kat bar.
Mm-hmm.
Magnificent. Absolutely glorious.
See, I've always been, as a matter of fact, even as a little kid, I was a dark chocolate guy. I love dark chocolate. And when white chocolate came along, I just could never get on board with it. It just didn't seem like chocolate to me at all. I didn't even know what that is. And yet, like you said, I mean, it seems to be the new trending thing. How long has this white chocolate Reese's peanut butter cup even been a thing?
I think they have it out like once a year for the last 2 or 3 years.
Never seen it. That's funny.
Along with the white Kit Kat bars. Now, but yeah, they're absolutely amazing. So, you godless honey, yeah. You churl, you knave. Someone on your Facebook page commented about it being more white privilege. Well, in this case, then I will say, yay unto thee, verily.
Very good. Now it does bring.
Hang on, sir.
Yes.
Done with this. My fist pounding is not finished. I am in the bully pulpit for the rights of white chocolate. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful, glorious, confectionate delight. Okay? And I am a big believer in the confectionacy of white chocolate.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. You can have mine.
I'll take it.
All right, very good. Now, do you remember back in, I want to say like 1981 or 82, on one of the pay channels, either HBO or Showtime, they ran a show with Rich Hall and Stuart Pankin and a whole bunch of American and Canadian comics called Not Necessarily the News.
I know of the show. As you and I once talked about it, we Staten Islanders did not have cable.
That's
until
right.
1988.
Yeah. Well, on this.
A lot of that stuff.
It was the birthplace of Rich Hall's Sniglets, and he put out several books on the subject, and it was words that are things that don't have a word for them yet. And they would just make up these words, and then people started sending them in, and it's very funny stuff. But the one that they never got to has a connection back to what we were just talking about, because the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup is unique among candies, or candy bars, if you want to call it one, in that it's the only one that you never get to eat all of, because never in the history of mankind has somebody been able to unwrap a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup without some of the bottom of the chocolate sticking to the wrapper. You never get to eat that part, and it seems to me that should have a name. That little bit of chocolate, like that Rorschach test that's always stuck to that brown paper wrapper on the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. It needs a name.
It's kind of like the process of unreasing. But the thing is, you know, why can't you just put it in a refrigerator and then try and peel it off so that way there's nothing stuck to the bottom? Wouldn't that be the most logical approach?
Yeah, but then you have to wait to eat your candy. Nobody does that.
But the point is, if you're going to go to the pains of trying to, you know, eat the whole goddamn thing, then chill it out for a little bit.
Yeah.
Besides that, when a candy bar is a little bit cold, we're not saying hard and frozen, but a little bit cold, it's just so much more enjoyable.
Unless it's a Snickers bar, in which case you can freeze them. Snickers bars freeze really well.
See, and the funny thing is, I'm one of those few people that just never liked Snickers. I'm either for Milky Way or Three Musketeers, because when it comes to candy bars, I'm not gaga for peanuts. But I want to tell you something. I was 42 years old before I had my first Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. I'd always stay away from them simply because of the horror story when they first came on the market that a whole slew of them had been found to have ants inside them. So, yeah. I mean, it's almost akin to saying, well, I also didn't eat White Castle burgers for a long time because of the whole horse meat scare, but it's
right.
White Castle. You don't know who's going to be in those burgers. I mean, you know, why do you think we always noticed who was still working at White Castle and who wasn't whenever we'd go and buy them?
That's right. And who knows? I mean, Hoffa could have been in there or may still be. And, you know, that brings up another thing, because those urban myths with the White Castle and the horse meat, McDonald's suffered through kangaroo meat back in the 70s. That was the big rumor going around about them. You mentioned the ants and the Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. The other one I remember, Bubblicious Bubblegum. You remember that stuff?
Of course.
For some reason, somehow, and I don't know how far or how widespread this was, but the rumor that went around our neighborhood is that they had spider eggs in them.
Ew.
Yeah, tell me about it.
And, of course, I stopped eating Pop Rocks because it killed Mikey from the
right.
Life Super commercials.
Of course. And, you know, a good friend of mine, I'm glad you brought that up, a good friend of mine was responsible for the marketing campaign 10 years later when they came back out onto the market in 1988. And it was, the reason why they took them off the market in 1978 was exactly because of what you said. That rumor was so pervasive that people stopped buying them, and it wasn't lucrative for them to make them anymore.
The other thing is they just didn't taste very good. They're just too sugary.
That's
you know?
True.
If you wanted something that was kind of weird tasting, have something like Razzles, because it was candy and a gum.
There you go. Yeah, in fact, one of the first candies I ever remember buying, I was probably 3 or 4 at the convenient market down on the corner, was Razzles. Love those things.
And now I think they only have it in one flavor.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe red.
Which, again, is just heinous. And by the way, what's the deal with having the Swedish fish only available in the red ones? What kind of abomination is that?
Well, I worship the ground that Swedish fish swim on. So
yeah, but you need all of them.
Look, you've got gummy bears and so on. But here's an asterisk for you for the end of that sentence. You do know that we don't even have the European version of the gummy bear. The gummy bears that are sold in the European market, and you could probably get them in places like Bed Bath & Beyond, because Bed Bath & Beyond has a foreign foods and candy section. Those contain grape-flavored gummy bears, which are absolutely this world. Don't ask me why they're not on the American market. I mean, we have the pineapple-flavored ones, the little clear white ones,
mm-hmm.
which are, I guess, tasty enough, but nothing compares to grape. But yes, we don't have even proper gummy bears. But what I was going to say is Swedish fish are Swedish fish. They are red, they stay red, and that's that. There are some things you don't fuck with. You don't tamper with, you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull the mask off the old Lone Ranger, and you sure as fuck don't put other colors in with Swedish fish. I'm a purist. You know that. I believe completely in the purity of all candy.
Yep.
Now, you want gummy bears, you can get the European ones, but you go and get gummy bears. Or you get, you know, Sour Patch Kids. But you want colors and different, you want rainbows and shit, go call a unicorn.
Go buy some Skittles. Well, you know what it comes down to it, though? Neither one of us ought to be eating gummy bears because that's TRAFE.
That's very true, but okay. You know, listen, when it's convenient, I don't roll on Shabbos. Otherwise, you know, give me a gummy bear. I don't care.
Attaboy. Oh, yeah, too much. Now, there are some things that are going on that over the course of this week have been in a much more serious vein, and we lost a couple of absolute giants this week out of the movie industry. And I want to start with Martin Landau, because even though he was the second one this week that we heard about who had died, Martin Landau forever has been the guy that you could count on to always put on an amazing performance, and never really got the credit and certainly never got the awards for it until it came to his portrayal of Bela Lugosi in Ed Wood, which granted was amazing, but that's not the first time that Martin Landau did something amazing, you know?
Two words as far as Martin Landau goes, Roland Hamm.
Yep.
That's how I know him. That's how I will always remember him. And then quite closely followed up by that was having been married to Barbara Bain. He was just such a knockout. But, you know, as a child, my introduction to Martin Landau was Mission Impossible, where I always found it very interesting that he was, quote, special guest star, even though he was the star of the show.
Every week, right.
Right. It was really the because most people don't remember this, and we don't know this, but Mission Impossible, when it went on the air, the star was Stephen Hill. It was not Peter Graves.
Right.
And it was, in fact, a co-starring lead of Stephen Hill as Dan Briggs, the head of the IMF, and Martin Landau as Roland Hand, the master of disguise. Apparently, Stephen Hill was a bit of a dilettante in those days. I'll briefly tell a little story about that at the end, just to clarify the how and why things changed. So what they did was they made Martin Landau every week's special guest star, which did give him a starring billing. So it was the opening of the credits and the end of the credits that had the two stars bookending one another.
That's funny.
And actually part of the problem with Stephen Hill was, and I do understand this actually, is that he was also at the time a very serious practicing Orthodox Jew and did not want to work on a TV show when it was time for Shabbos on Fridays. That led to a lot of problems, considering that the main writers and directors of the show were also Jewish, but, you know, he was Orthodox, didn't want to work. A lot of problems. They wound up firing him and replacing him with Peter Graves. And, of course, starting with the second season, Martin Landau was in the regular credits as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, now, from the likes of playing Roland Hand to going to Space 1999.
Yes.
You know, it was quite a transition. I was never, you know, as a kid, I was never into sci-fi. Sci-fi for me began and really ended with Star Wars. But I watched the show simply because I was a big fan of Mission Impossible and of Barbara Bain.
Sure.
I didn't love the show, but I watched it. You know, the thing about Martin Landau is his acting was so natural and so good. People forget that before Mission Impossible, he was great as being that sort of bit part player in major movies as the heavy, the bad guy, not the lead bad guy, but the henchman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the one with the gun, you know, always carrying out some kind of nefarious plot. And he was always so good at it. You love to hate the guy. And he was the master of it. And of course, as Bela Lugosi, it is one of the most powerful and yet hysterical performances you've ever seen anyone do. He was so masterful at it. You know, I can't even watch the real Ed Wood movies, and I certainly can't watch anything with Bela Lugosi without imagining Martin Landau, because
right.
He just took that and ran with it so well.
When he said, when his character, and I'm sure this is pulled right from reality, described Boris Karloff as that limey bastard. Every time I see that movie, I'm waiting for that one. And when he says, bullshit.
I love, that's where I got it. That's why I always say, bullshit.
Yep.
I think he actually said that limey cocksucker.
Yeah, you're right.
That was the line. That was the line. And yeah, he did say that. I mean, he was so strung out all the time. It was an amazing thing that he was shooting for formaldehyde. You know, but in the times that I've seen that horrible opening to to Plan 9 from outer space, you know, hunted, despised. You know, there's no way I will ever be able to listen to or watch Bela Lugosi without it being Landau's voice in my head.
Right, yeah. And the thing about that is I remember seeing him, and I think it was on an Inside the Actors Studio, when he described how much of a chore that was for him, because Landau said, he's like you and me, when he talks, it's all outward. You know, he throws his hands out and he talks with his hands and all of this. And he said Lugosi is the exact opposite of that. Everything is pulled in. And he, you know, he had to have his hands and fists all the time because that's how Lugosi was. And he said there was so much consciousness going on with the acting of the body movements and things like that, that it was hard to remember to do the voice too.
Well, you know, Landau had that New York Jew thing. that's what the talking with the hands.
Right. Really, exactly. You know? Exactly.
You know? But the thing is that, you know, it's, yeah, I think he's actually being very, very generous in saying that. You're also talking about someone who has gone already at that point, you know, 40, 50 years
yep.
by the time that he had gotten to do the role. So you're not going to actually have that much of a framework to really be able to refer back from. You know, you're only, I would think, imagining what conversations with Lugosi might have been like,
mm-hmm.
his negotiations with Ed Wood. All you had was, you know, Lugosi on screen. Which is, you know, anyone on screen is a far difference from the person they are in real life.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, how do you know he wasn't really flailing his arms like a maniac? You know?
Could very well have been, but still, yeah, just some amazing work, an amazing body of work. And by the way, with Space 1999, I got into that because my dad was into it, and that spawned a parody series called Quark that aired on PBS.
That was the spot. What spurred it on?
Yeah, Space 19. Wow. Quark was sort of a direct, not a direct parody, but
I was talking to Will Harris about this on Facebook just recently.
Yeah,
no one ever brings up Quark.
Love it.
The Barnstable twins.
Right. Yeah. Ben the clones. Right.
Right. Tim Thomerson is what was it? Jean and. And of course, the late Richard Kelton is Ficus.
Ficus, the tree. And the episode, my favorite episode of Quark ever, was the one where Ficus has to, where he gets the girlfriend, and he has to teach her how they, you know, how they do it on his planet. And they have to sit there with their hands and feet in the air and call for the bee. I was on the floor. It was fucking hilarious.
What was it? Friday nights on NBC, right?
Yeah, for a very short period of time. Him and Conrad...
Conrad Bain was on there.
Well. Conrad Janis. Conrad Bain was the guy from yeah, Different Strokes.
Right. Sorry. You know what it is? You get one Conrad too many. Conrad Janis, his gentleman's haircut.
Yep.
And Mork and Mindy.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, that was what he did right before Mork and Mindy.
Yes. Right.
Because it was 1970. It was early 78 that Quark was on.
The intergalactic garbage scow.
I was going to say, who doesn't love a TV series about a garbage scow? Come on.
It was just fantastic. So, yeah, if you have never seen Quark, seek that out. It's got to be on one of the streamers somewhere, but definitely worth a watch.
Quark rates up there with a show like When Things Were Rotten.
Yes, right. Yeah, that was the Mel Brooks, what do you call it, Robin Hood story.
Dick Gautier is Robin Hood.
Just fantastic. Oh, man. And of course, you have the other name that we lost this week, a giant in the horror industry, but just a giant in movie making. I mean, when you mention the name George Romero and the number of people over time who have worked for that guy, and I had, let me tell a quick story here. I had the opportunity about 8 years ago. There was a sci-fi and horror convention that came to town, and they brought in every living member of the cast of Night of the Living Dead. And the reverence, I mean, he was still alive. He just died. He was still very much alive at that point and very much an ongoing concern making things like Return of the Living Dead and or not Return of the Living Dead, but the, you know, the remake of Day of the Dead. And the reverence with which they spoke about him was an amazing thing. And to a man, every single one of them was like, I would not have wanted to work for anybody else in the industry at that point.
He doesn't really get the credit that's due him, but he was, I think, the groundbreaker of what we now call horror.
Yep.
You know, there were, how do you want to call it? Thrillers, you know, the stuff that you and I grew up with, like on Chiller Theater.
Right.
Right. And even through, you know, the Hitchcockian era. they were thrillers. They were psychological dramas. They were, you know, but they weren't really horror films. He's the one that broke ground with the original Night of the Living Dead, which is such a terrible, cheap-looking film, but it is so gripping.
Yep.
That it does give you the creeps. That movie succeeded because it got you to feel what you didn't think you'd feel. And that was like,
yeah. Yeah. Well, and there was a lot of things about that movie that you look back on it and you say, that was groundbreaking stuff. I mean, he wasn't the first one to make everybody the enemy. I mean, I think Psycho, to a degree, the reason that that succeeded like it did is because the horror didn't look like a monster. He just looked like a nice-looking kid. And in, with Night of the Living Dead and with certainly 1973's The Crazies, which is an outstanding movie, you know, Romero made your neighbors the potential monsters. Everybody was potentially dangerous. But the thing about Night of the Living Dead is you had for the first time not only a black leading actor, but a black hero. The guy who was the only one who had it all together, who had a plan. And of course, for the five people who haven't seen Night of the Living Dead, the original 68 version, I won't spoil the ending for you. But the ending, it meant a lot in terms of what was going on at the time of the civil rights struggle. And yet, it was just an accident. He did not seek out a black actor to play that character. It just so happened he put in the best performance at rehearsals and they went, that guy.
The thing is that, you know, what you just said about Psycho, Norman Bates is the one who comes off as the sympathetic character.
Right. He's the loser in that one. Sure.
Right. You know, and everybody else is, he's misunderstood and he's the one being pursued. With Night of the Living Dead, however, you clearly see that even though, yeah, it could be your friends, your neighbors, and so on and so forth, You see the very clear dividing line of, okay, this is a case of it's us versus them, which I think in a lot of very subtle ways spoke about society at that particular moment.
Sure.
Because we're now coming out of the summer of love and into the year of absolute discontent, which, as everybody knows, 1968 pretty much was. People still refer back to 1968 as that watershed year with where everything went wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you had the assassinations, certainly, and the riots. And I mean, it was all of the promise of a year before that just dashed against the rocks. So again, it was fundamentally serendipitous that it came out at the time that it did, that it had the things to say that it did, even if they didn't intend them that way.
Right.
It worked.
It was a very, very, let's just say it was a very subtle message.
Right.
I'm not sure if it was a conscious one, but it was a subtle one. And really, that's why that movie is such a groundbreaker.
Yeah. And the thing with Romero is, like I mentioned with The Crazies, they remade that in 2010 and didn't do a half bad job with it. But it's one of those movies that gets swept under because it wasn't another zombie movie, sort of. But, you know, it's worth the watch. And Romero's career is like that. There are things that you find along the way and you go, oh, I didn't know that was his, or things that you look down his IMDb profile and say, I've never seen that movie. Go see that movie. It's going to be worthwhile.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, poor Tom Savini. Now what?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but he's a genius. He'll be fine. Tom's a good dude, too. He was one of the ones that was there at that convention and just a wonderfully magnanimous guy. And again, very reverential to George Romero.
Well, this was the week of losing... This was the week of losing.
Yeah. Now, we do have some good things to talk about, though, because, well, I got to hand this one off to you because I must make a confession. Since its inception, and I know one day we will get to it, but it's one of those that just got swept under the rug with us, Game of Thrones completely eluded me. And now here we are, you know, seeing its return. And, you know, once again, I have to stand there at the water cooler and be that guy who doesn't know what the hell anybody's talking about.
The only reason why I watch the show is, especially right now, is there's nothing else on Sunday night.
Yeah.
Up against it. If I had my druthers, I'm sure there would be some other programs. And plus, my wife is, for whatever reason, a huge fan. It's by default, really, that I watch.
Okay.
Last week's season opener was apparently the biggest audience HBO's ever drawn. In their very lengthy history, which is quite a statement. I would think that would not be the case because of The Sopranos, but no, apparently this was bigger. Game of Thrones is possibly one of the most successful series ever to run on any form of television network.
They're out of the books now, right? I mean, they've gone beyond George R. R. Martin's books and now are into their own universe.
Correct. Okay. And I think they only have one more year to do after this. They're going to do actually what AMC always tends to do, a first half of a season and then the final concluding episodes. You know, the way they split Mad Men in two and Breaking Bad in two. And so that's what they're going to do here. You know, it's the thing about Game of Thrones is if you were to come into it now, it would take you a while to begin to catch up. It's a show that you have to be watching from the very beginning.
Okay.
And I bleep in and out, but I know where things are at because I've been bleeping in and out for so long that I also have my wife's help to guide me along. But, you know, it's fun, if there's nothing else that's fun, and I certainly always enjoyed as a kid, without question, you know, the lights of the mythology of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and all of that. You know, it's a good, entertaining program. But the thing is, now that we've brought in the topic of television, you know, and this being a summer show, surprisingly enough right now, there are other shows that are on the air that people have really neglected to talk about, which is kind of an odd thing because with all the bigger name shows being off, either off the air because they've concluded their run, or they're off for the season.
Right.
You know, like The Walking Dead. This leads me to going back to what we were talking about last week when I referred to Cinemax's insanity and head-scratching questionability about canceling Quarry, which had been a success, and we don't even know yet if Outcast will be back for a second season on Cinemax because of their desire to go back to having action shows on Friday nights. And by the way, Outcast's second season has already run and concluded in England on Fox. Now, I don't know how the English Fox network runs, if they show things in their entirety and uncensored, because Outcast is one of those shows that would certainly need censoring if it's going to be shown on any kind of network.
Right.
But the fact that, you know, Cinemax has done things so half-assed, you know, you've got other shows that are on right now that need a little bit of exposure because they're out there and they're really good. Case in point, AMC has Preacher, which is actually created by the likes of Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen. And it's one of those horror, fantasy, you know, completely unreal, you know, a preacher, his mob wife girlfriend, and his best friend, who happens to be a vampire, make their way through the South. You know, I mean, it's definitely in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
It's funny as all get out, but, you know, there you go. There's one show for you. That's on a Monday night. Then you've got Turn, Washington Spies, also on AMC, is making its, I hate to say it, making its way to the finish line. You know, it's a historically based series. But it is so well written, so well acted. The look of it is magnificent. But it's coming to the end. People should be picking up on it because it's been a hit for the 4 years that it's been on.
Mm-hmm.
That people should at least be smart enough to tune in and pay attention to the fact that they're going to see what happens next. You know, it amazes me that summer TV is just being tripped over on an almost constant basis. Animal Kingdom, which is now in its second season on TNT, starring Ellen Barkin. Absolutely fascinating show. It's based on an Australian movie from a couple of years ago.
I remember the movie, yeah.
And her performance is beyond words. I mean, she's such a great actress to begin with. And, you know, all I can say about this show is, if you didn't know it was on TNT, you would expect it to fully be an HBO, Cinemax, Showtime kind of series. That's on Tuesday nights. And it's gotten great ratings because obviously they brought that back for a second year. It did that well in its first run. But people, not enough people know about it. And, you know, I'm going to throw in one comedy just for the sake of throwing in it because I think people forgot that it's on. And that's also on TNT. And that's Angie Tribeca with Rashida Jones.
That's a funny show. That really is well done.
so reminiscent. It's got to have taken all of its cues from Police Squad.
The Police Squad, Airplane, sure, all the Zucker Brothers stuff.
But the thing is that it's even though it's done in that vein, it's still in the now, and it still works. Because right. No matter what era you put it in, that kind of humor will always work.
Yeah, it will. And you know what? That you led me into something off of TV and back into the movies for a second, because I was thinking about this the other day. Somebody brought up something. I don't know. I wish I could remember the reference, but it reminded me of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And whenever I go off on these little mind jaunts, I go down a particular through line of movies like that and into Airplane and all of that. And from there into what those kind of anarchic madcap comedies became in the 80s, where they entered the teen realm with movies like Better Off Dead. And it's been a while since we've seen a successful madcap comedy. And I don't know. I mean, I would hate to think that whole oeuvre is just run its course. But I don't know if there's enough money in it anymore for Hollywood to make a big movie like that and take a chance on something that's just insanely funny.
I don't think it's run its course. I think it's the fact that very few to no writers have the absolute cleverness.
True.
And the skill to sit down and write something that would be a big cast. Because look, on the same wave, you no longer have the disaster pictures like you used to have the
earthquake.
Earthquake side adventure. You don't have that kind of thing anymore. And I'm pretty sure you could get some massive names to appear if it was a good script that is just going to make you, almost shit your pants with laughter.
The Ocean series did that, and they had huge names.
Close as you could get, but still it was based on something else.
Right.
And, was trying to, George Clooney's trying to do the Rat Pack thing, but I was going to say, I can easily picture Brad Pitt in the same cast with Zach Galifianakis, It's that kind of, I know exactly the kind of movie you're talking about. It's just that I don't think there are enough good writers out there that can bring the funny and translate it into that kind of a film, unless they were going to redo, and that's the part that I hate, redo something like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World with younger actors.
Yeah, please don't. Hollywood, if you're listening, please don't do that. But with Brad Pitt, I don't know, do you watch much Comedy Central?
I've seen Brad Pitt as the now fired weatherman.
The weatherman on the Jim Jeffries show. Jim Jeffries, if you've never seen his stand-up, do that, first of all, because he's incredibly funny. We had the luck to see him live about 5-6 years ago, and he has a better knack for shoving an audience over the cliff and then pulling them back. He does that better than anybody. But his TV show, I think we've said this before, I caught on right from the beginning. It's great. And with the Brad Pitt bits, he does just enough with him. I don't know how that happened. I don't know if the two of them are buds or whatever, but doesn't matter. The little bit that you get to see Brad Pitt on that show is just brilliant. And they brought him back on the last episode, live from Venice. And it was, again, it wasn't live. I mean, they pre-taped the thing, obviously, but still, it was hysterically funny. And just to see him as the weatherman, not even named, not even Brad Pitt or weather guy, just as the weatherman, is just hilarious. Well done.
I mean, I thought that the whole layout of, we have to cut back on the show. I mean, we fired our weatherman, he was sitting at home drunk.
Right.
And crying in front of the TV. And then, they bring him back in the end anyhow.
Yep.
The thing is about Brad Pitt, though, because I think people forget that the guy does have a really good sense of humor. He's also the guy that was kidnapped by, 3 or 4 pandas or gorillas off the street.
Yeah.
And shoved in a van on Jackass.
Right.
Because he was friends with those guys too. So I bet it's a friendship thing with Jim Jeffries. The problem is Brad Pitt's been now so long aligned with the whole Angelina Jolie bullshit thing.
Yep.
That, it takes away from the fact that he's a funny guy. He's a normal guy like the rest of us. So he's not in that typical, I hate him, that sex symbol kind of shit. I like him. I think he's brilliant. And let's face it, Aldo the Apache is all I have to say.
Well, it's a lot of fun to watch him pop up in these different places. So I'm hoping that that little bit continues as much as Brad Pitt is able to do it. But yeah, if you haven't been watching Jim Jeffries, you're missing out, because again, I mean, the commentary is on point. I think over time, like Trevor Noah did on The Daily Show, Jim Jeffries will get more comfortable in that genre, you know, in the talk show thing, and just him alone in front of the camera. He's a little too stand-up-y still, but I think he'll lose that.
But you know what? The thing is, this is Jim Jeffries' show. It's his vehicle.
Yep.
Trevor Noah, I have not become, and I probably never will become, a fan of nor accept him, because that show, even though Jon Stewart took over from Craig Kilborn, that was a dying enterprise when he took it over.
Yep.
He made it his show. And Comedy Central's lack of vision just led them to hand it over to Trevor Noah, who I find incredibly unfunny. No matter how I slice it, he's just not funny. I don't like him. And they should have ended it. Larry Wilmore never got the chance. This is the problem I have with Comedy Central. Larry
right.
Wilmore never got enough of a run to make that show, that time slot, or any of that his. And more people than I can count were saying, why don't they just flip the shows? Larry Wilmore is a lot more fun and a lot more interesting to watch than this idiot taking over for Jon Stewart. Put Larry Wilmore on at 11, put Daily Show at 11:30. Well, now also Chris Hardwick's At Midnight is ending, although that was allegedly a mutual thing. And I think it's also because Chris Hardwick does more things on AMC, et cetera, which are all part of NBC Universal. So there's got to be a conflict between NBC Universal and Viacom CBS.
Right, right.
So I just think that Comedy Central had better do what's smart and keep Jim Jeffries on and let him build that audience and build that impetus, because he's got a great lead in. And frankly, as much as I love the show and have grown to just find it worth stopping everything to watch, I don't know how Tosh still manages to get away with his show.
Yeah.
And the shit that he says, because he's taking comedy where you and I would take it, because we're uncensored and we can say what we want. He's doing it on clean TV because it's on at 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Tosh.0, Daniel Tosh, is one funny motherfucker. And Tosh.0, if you've never seen it, you really don't know what you're missing, because all he's doing is showing and pointing out the foibles of real people making complete assholes of themselves for the sake of attention.
Yeah, exactly. And boy, do we have a lot of that. Look at me. I'm an attention whore. So well done to him. And I tell you, if Comedy Central is going to kick themselves in the ass for anything, it should be letting John Oliver get away. Because, oh man, I mean, the show that he puts in, granted, it's only once a week on HBO, but it's just incredible. And he has grown his own best bit, and his best bit, and he's talked about this on the air on the show, is taking something that seems overly complex and pedantic and makes it understandable for everybody, and then pokes exactly the right joke in at it.
The thing about John Oliver is that I would think, because I've watched the show since it's been on, I don't feel I could take it more than once a week.
Yeah.
That's the problem with it. If it was on five nights a week, it might wear thin really quickly.
Also true. Also true. So yeah, he's in a good spot. But he also, when he was guesting on The Daily Show, when Stewart took off to make his movie, to make Rosewater, he did a hell of a job. And I think everybody was ready for him to fall on his ass, and he didn't.
The other thing is, you know, look at Colbert. Now, I will grant you, the two shows are completely different.
Yep.
The Colbert Report was a concept comedy. You know, there was a whole point behind it. And the character, and that's the key word, the character of Colbert was you know, not who Stephen Colbert is. I think even though he's grown further into the role of being a regular talk show host, the fact is that he's still a little too smart for the audiences.
Yep.
And I say that because Letterman, who I think was the absolute king of comedy late night, was also too smart for the audiences, and his shtick didn't play as well at 11:30. Let's be brutally honest. People want watered down, safe as milk, tepid nothingness at 11:30.
Leno.
Carson wasn't that. Johnny Carson was the master.
Right.
Bar none. But when he stepped down and they had Jay Leno, Jay Leno is about as innocuous as you can get.
Yeah.
So you go from something innocuous and bland like Jay Leno And we won't even count the Conan period, because that was just a misstep on every level. And it's not a knock against Conan. It's a knock against NBC.
Sure.
You put in somebody like Jimmy Fallon, who's about as interesting as a bowl of mayonnaise. And, you know, you're going to get the ratings because it's safe.
Yeah.
Colbert is still too smart. He's got the Letterman thing down. It's the smartness, the intelligence, you know, the political bite that the opening monologues would always have. And I think that intimidates a certain audience. Basically, you get a little bit, even though I have no love of the left, you get the more left-leaning audiences watching Colbert, and you get the middle of the road and the right watching Fallon.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Your political divide.
Yeah. Well, either way, I mean, that's why the variety is out there, I guess. And in the meantime, it gives us a good chance to hop over into the music world. And we've got some things out this week that I think are really fantastic. And it's funny because if there's any kind of connectivity between the three of them that are featured on Pop Dos this week, it's that they owe a lot to the Rolling Stones. And I want to kick off with Lisa Saeed, because you and I are both just enamored with not only her persona when she's on stage and when she's in the videos, but also with the music and the voice. It all just works. And Pop Dos premiered a single, I think, that's off of the new EP back in May. And now the EP is out. How does it flesh out?
I think it fleshes out great, because it seems like she split the sides into two distinctive music styles, the rock side and the country side.
Yep.
And it's very clear. And I don't know if she consciously did it, but it's the first two songs are the rock songs. The second two songs are country-ish. And the thing that I like about this EP that I really was able to sink my teeth into from first listen, you know, and I'm not saying that as opposed to the album, but the sound of this EP has a consistency through the four tracks. Now, the EP is shorter. But the thing is that the meat of the songs is so much greater. It's almost like going to a smorgasbord. You know, you get primed up with the salad, you know, and then you have your you have some salad, you have a shrimp cocktail. Then they bring you the steak and you get dessert. This is a full four-course meal.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that in a humorously styled way. You get everything, even though it's rock and country. And the sound of this EP is so coherent and consistent. You know, the album had it had a bit more of a, there were some songs that didn't fit the production style of each song, whereas this one is just rock solid all the way through. But then again, it's been about a year or so since that album was recorded. You know, we wrote about the album in something like September.
Yeah.
The EP is now, it's July, and, you know, she's written a ton of new songs since. She's got these four now down pat on tape and available. So you can tell that she's been evolving and growing, and that she's put her own life into these songs again. And I think that's also a key component. These are all very personal songs. They're songs anyone can relate to. It doesn't matter about your gender. You
know? Right.
For all you social justice warrior douchebags out there, you know, going to get all up in arms and your panties are all going to get up into a bunch. But the thing is that she writes about songs that I've definitely written or can relate to.
Yeah.
You know, it's about shitty relationships and why did I invest my time in this? And, you know, how could I have been so unwise? And how could that person have been such a piece of shit? You know, she gets to the heart of the matter, and that's what I really like. Plus her voice, there's something about her voice that just will drive you crazy in the best way.
The EP is called Estranged, and the song that you've got linked, the SoundCloud link that's on the page alongside the review, is for a song called Some Dudes, and that's where the Rolling Stones connection comes in, because it sounds like it could have come off of Some Girls. The writing is funny. The style of music is just right along that same kind of very loose and yet very directed kind of sound, and the guitar in that's holy shit. I mean, if every song could have a guitar, that's
guitar.
Oh,
dun, 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 dun. But you know what? That's what I find really interesting. You said that now, and I thought of that after I'd listened to it and written the review, because I was thinking Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
To me, Waiting for the Man. That's what it was.
Right.
That same dun, 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 dun. The thing is, it doesn't matter which one of those influences played a part in it. this song has such hair on its balls. I mean, she just went, it's such a, that's why I was immediately taken with just the first listen of it. And I thought, it's a holy shit moment.
Some dudes want everything. Some dudes say they can't feel a thing. Some dudes, I make the name blue.
It's great. And the other one that I thought just took a lot of influence directly from the Rolling Stones again is an album that's out called Cry for Help by Glenn Morrow. Now, I'm going to defer to you on this to give us a little bit of background, because I know this is a guy who grew up same neck of the woods you did. Who is Glenn Morrow?
Glenn Morrow, well, let's go back in time. Glenn Morrow was the singer and guitarist in a band called A, in quotation marks. A did songs about chicks, working, and life in New Jersey. Oh, and electricians.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't go down that well for a long time. They broke up, and Glenn Morrow went off and did his own thing. A became the Bongos. Hint, hint, hint.
Right.
People go back and read Pop Dose, really, or listen to our old shows in either permutation. You'll know the story by now. Glenn Morrow then formed a band called The Individuals, who became the Weigels later on. But The Individuals were a great, quirky, new wavy band. Then he had a great band called Rage to Live. And he also was one of the co-founders of the beloved Bar None Records label, which he still is the owner of. But this is his first full-on solo album, and it's called Glenn Morrow's Cry for Help. I think it's very clever, very witty, almost predictably him. You know, the lyrics to the songs are all very... they're Springsteen-esque, which he always had that kind of leaning, you know, the songs of the working man and the fist in the air and so on and so forth. But they're edited. You know what I mean? They're not these long 4-page treatises of words. You know, it's just, you know, we're going to get through this. It's going to be all right. You know, and, you know, it's a fun listen. It's great. And what's interesting is that, you know, he's not your typical singer. He almost veers into that sing speak style,
right?
You know,
yeah. And there's, it's funny because the lyrics themselves, you mentioned the intelligence of the writing, and that's where I was listening to Tangled Up in Blue this morning. It just happened to come on the radio, and I thought, okay, it's been a little while, I'm going to go back and listen to this one again. And when you start adding in, like, Bleaker in Third is the song that you've got linked along with the review, and you add in things like that, where you put a song in a particular geographic location, you say, this is where we are, and this is what's going on as I look around myself. That's a very cool device if you can pull it off. And he pulls it off. And he pulls it off because it doesn't overtake the song. It's just a piece of it. It's setting the scene.
And you hear the chord, and man, it really shook the place. Send us all out in the outer space. Now fuel for the fire don't need to be firewood. Smoke 'em if you got 'em and don't look under the hood. And you built some.
I tend to look at albums and dissect the ones that, you know, they have that certain something about them, the music, and but it always almost seems too clinically serious. Whereas this is a good time record.
Now, right.
You know, there's a track on there called Electricity, which to me had a feel of an updated or more modern Loving Spoonful.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and if you're talking about good time music, that's the embodiment of it right there. So whether or not the Spoonful had anything to do with, you know, the influences that went into this album with Glenn Morrow, I don't know. But nevertheless, it's a good time album. It's a joyful album. It's fun. And it makes you think in a time of a lot of discomfort. You know, I think we've overlaid ourselves, all of us collectively as a people, with music right now that is just so heavy and serious because of everybody almost being too paranoid, too angry, and too upset to think clearly enough to basically decompress. The only way to get peace of mind and be able to think in a better manner, in a stronger manner, going forward, is to step back from being angry all the time. And this album is one of those records that you just don't feel angry listening to. You can't be.
Yeah.
It may make you think, but it's certainly not going to piss you off and get you fired up against the government.
Yeah, and you can also, you can listen to it one of two ways. You can listen to it in that very sort of academic way, but you can also, this is an album that very much, because of that good time feel, lends itself to passive listening very well. So it's one to check out. Glenn Morrow's Cry for Help, and again, the review is elsewhere on the site. The other one you've got a review for this week, before we get into Native Heart from Roger Klein, the new one that we've been talking about now for like a month, is an album from a band called Recluse, and I mean, let's start with that. I love the cleverness of the name.
Yep. A band from Pittsburgh, you know, a band from the Steel City. And this is their debut album. And I like the title, too, because it's called Okay, Recluse.
Yeah, right.
You can take it one of two ways. And I think that's, you know, cleverness abounds. But the thing is, this band really has that. They're young, but they've got themselves firmly rooted in AM radio of the 70s. And they don't make any. They don't hide one shred of that influence or that style. You know, you listen to the first track, and it's called Long Time Listener, First Time Caller, which I automatically think of Bruce from Flushing on WFAN.
Right, yeah, the talk radio host in me really loves that song.
I'm a long time listener, but I'm a first time caller, no. I'm a long time listener, and I'm down on my knees tonight. I'm praying that the next song saves my life.
And all I can picture is Steve Summers on the overnight shift on WFAN, summer of 92. And then, yeah, this is Bruce from Larchmont, first time, long time. it's automatic trigger of thought. But the first things that I thought of on listening to this track were the band and Little Feet.
Yeah.
You know?
And those aren't bad things to think about.
No. And then you go to a song like I Do Right, and that is, and it's a piano-driven track, and it's really upbeat, and it is so Harry Nilsson. It's not funny. It's like, okay, these kids have sat and listened to the Nilsson catalog.
Yeah.
There's no way that they haven't, you know, and they've got it down pat. But you listen to it, and the great thing is this is a debut album by a young band from Pittsburgh, and it sounds like a million-dollar production, too.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing, and it's funny because you look at them and they have certainly, I mean, they've all got beards, they have that nouveau hipster kind of look to them, and yet the sound is anything but that, which I think is, it's not at all what I expected it to be when I saw their picture.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you and I talked about this, you very brilliantly brought it up a few shows ago about you hear a name and you know immediately what you're going to get.
Yeah.
You see a picture and you think you know what you're going to get. And unfortunately, even though I'm bearded, but that's because I've had a beard since I was born. And if were I to shave it off, it would be back in an hour, kind of like Heston when he goes up the mountain and comes back down again.
Right, but, right.
You know, that's natural for me. You know, I see a beard in a band and I know, douchebag. So that's going to be my automatic knee-jerk reaction. As you wisely pointed out here, not the case, because most hipster douchebag bands right now all have that same kind of mopey, I'm a jerk off kind of sound to them. It's either going to be one of two things. It's all going to be this, oh, look, I have a battered acoustic guitar and it's all that kind of.
And a banjo.
Right. Bon Iver shit. Or on the flip side of fuckheads like that band, then these really fucking irksome bands that do that kind of. Oway, oway, oway sound, kind of those, I don't even know how to describe it, those almost stadium chant, Broadway-themed,
right.
Bristed, limp-dicked, no balls, no substance, just big sounding nothingness.
Yep.
Bands like Fun.
Exactly. But yeah, these guys don't fall into either camp. It's a very neat thing to watch. Somebody that is that young and yet understands it, gets it, and doesn't think, I have to make music sound saleable right now, which is a hideous way to go about creating art. Now, there's one more thing, and it brings us back into a band that you and I both really dug right away as soon as we heard these guys, because they were in that same camp. They didn't have the same look about them, but they were very young. And when you see somebody that's in their early 20s and they build a rock band that sounds like a rock band that's been touring around for a while and really understands it, that's the vibe that we both got from a band called A Fragile Tomorrow. And I loved it because they did a call back to Noddy Holder, and I've been a Slade fan since I was able to listen, you know, since I was old enough to pick my own records. So that was really cool. But we got some sad news out of that band this week. What happened?
Well, literally the moment you and I disconnected from our last conversation, we got word that Vicky Stein-Kelly, who was the mother of Sean and Dominic, who are the driving forces, if you will, of A Fragile Tomorrow, and their brother Brendan, passed away after a very lengthy battle with cancer. And from the time that I've known those guys, she had been ill. And she had been fighting valiantly. It was almost in a lot of ways. I know this may sound very, very cliched, but it you know, this hit home very powerfully for me because I never got the pleasure of meeting her. I had a few encounters with her online on Facebook. She was a lovely, lovely woman. She loved those boys. She loved that band and supported them completely. But she was just such an all-around open person, and she fought with every bit of her being. And, you know, when you think you can't fight anymore, you know, they got what they thought was a reprieve from this. And then late last year came back with a vengeance. And the fact that she was able to make it this far is quite a testament to her own strength and fortitude. But, you know, I know the Kelly boys, and I know Dominic and Sean and Brendan, after the several years that I've not just been a fan, but I like to think of myself as a friend of the band, and their father, Pat, who I know what they're going through. You know, when I lost my mother, seeing how my father reacted to it, you know, it was hard. It was very hard. It was sudden for us. But all I want to do is just say to them, you know, I send my love to you guys, and, you know, I'm here, and there's a whole world out there that's able to extend their hands to you. You know, you have a lot of friends who love you and care about you, and we're going to miss Vicky. And yeah, I don't know what to say beyond that. It's just a very, very sad piece of news to receive. It's you never want to hear it, but because she was such a almost patron saint to them, if you will, you know, and to that whole music community, you know, I wanted to single her out for the fact that you know, she put up this blog chronicling what she was going through, and it's just such an unbelievable read. You know, if you're not sobbing by the time you read your way through it, you don't have a heart.
Yeah.
But you know, I just wanted to say, you know, I'm there for you guys, and send my love to them.
You got it. Yeah, all the condolences and all the love in the world, guys. Keep doing what you do, and thank you to her for supporting them as much as she did over her life. And we've got a couple more things to get into. We'll get into the In Our Head segment of the show in just a couple of minutes. But before we do that, to give a little bit of background, we all have our favorite bands, and mine just happened to come along when I was about 25 years old, so it's a good 20 years plus now ago, that I just tripped over a band on late night MTV called The Refreshments.
So just how far down do you want to go? Well, we could talk it out over a cup of Joe, and you could look deep into my eyes like I was a supermodel.
Since then, Roger Klein and P.H. Naffa, the lead singer and drummer for that band, have formed Roger Klein and the Peacemakers out of its ashes in 1997. And for 20 years, they've been on the road and making records the whole way. I mean, I believe this latest one that came out, Native Heart, was the 11th or 12th studio album from them. So, you know, they're of varying style and varying quality, but you know, I've been following this band, followed them down to Mexico and saw shows that they did down there a few times, and have really gotten to know the guys in the band over time. So for me, when Native Heart came out, I was listening for a lot of different things. But Rob, I know the one song Bandidos that the Refreshments did and the theme song to King of the Hill are the two things that they became known for over time. So you know both of them. But between then and now, you haven't been anywhere near as sort of inside with this band as I have. So I'm curious with this latest album, since this is probably the first full album of theirs that you've gotten to hear at all, how it struck you.
Well, as I was saying before we went on the air, you know, this is completely new for me. So I would think that if I was going to get, personally speaking, an introduction to this band, this is a good introduction, a really good introduction. I love the sound of it. I love the sound of the guitars. It's really, really crisp.
Yeah.
You know? And the drums are crisp. You know, this is a top-notch production. And even though I haven't had the chance to live with the album and let it, you know, stew around in my head for a while, you know, when you hear it on first listen, this is really good. This is something I enjoy. And there are at least three songs I can tell you just right off the top of my head that I liked from the get-go. I think Every Kind of Lucky is a great song.
Mm-hmm.
I think Barons to Break is a really interesting song.
Yeah.
And Shady Side is a great song.
Most of the places you call home, I see the faces smile and glow. They're taking my orphan heart. They show me the wicked ways. Come on, sit a spell, dear hot-headed fool. Rest your bones a while. We're the best folks to here on the shady side. Everything's cool here on the shady side. Here on the shady side.
Granted, I'm picking three out of how many songs are on here?
10, 11? It's a 10-song album, yeah.
But the thing is, those were the ones that stood out to me. So when you have an album that's got immediate standouts, you know the band's done something right. It doesn't matter who they are. It's the fact that they've done something right.
Yeah. And you know, I go back and I listen to this again with the ear of somebody who's been with them all the way along. And the one track that you pulled out that was among my favorites on first listening through was Barons to Break, because I think of all 10 of them, that one and Arizona Night are probably the two that have the most in common with the early Refreshments stuff. And so that's always going to get me on board. And, you know, like anything, this album is going to have its highs and lows for, you know, given any different listener, you're going to find things that you really gravitate toward. But yeah, I think that it's probably their most solid effort since, oh, about 10 years ago. They had two albums in a row. Americano came out and it was followed immediately by No More Beautiful World. And they had such high quality writing on them. And it was, again, it was like Fizzy Fuzzy Big and Buzzy, the first Refreshments album, in that there wasn't a weak track on any, you know, either one of those albums. They were just great from beginning to end. So this is probably their most solid piece of work since then. And it doesn't sound a lot like the last three or four albums from them. So I don't know if that was a conscious reaching back into the past or if it's just, you know, the growth of a songwriter to naturally dip back into some of the things that got you to where you are.
Well, that's the beauty of certain records. And when a band can do that, when they can put 10, 12, 14 songs that you want to listen to all the way through without taking a break from it.
Yeah.
That means the band has done something that very few can do.
Yep.
And it's very, very rare that you can get that. I don't care who you are, you know, Revolver has its bathroom breaks.
Right. So, yeah, it is. It's definitely worth a listen. And like you said, Rob, I mean, if somebody is brand new to this band and wants to go and grab something new that will give them an ear for what they've done along the way, this is a pretty good one. So Native Heart is the new one from Roger Klein and the Peacemakers. And that brings us, I do believe, to the In Our Heads segment of the program. And there was another song that just happened to hit me this morning. I heard a couple of Creedence tracks just almost back to back. And the first one was Who'll Stop the Rain. And Who'll Stop the Rain to me is one of those songs that it almost sounds like every rock band, I think, has its homage to its audience. And I don't know what the story is behind John Fogerty's writing in that song, but that's when it gets to that, that line about all the, you know, the crowded rush together trying to keep warm. I see, you know, an outdoor show taking place in a blinding rainstorm, and I'm sure that they've been in that place before.
Heard the singers playing, how we cheered for more. Crowded rush together, trying to keep warm. Still the rain kept pouring, falling on my ears. And I wonder, who'll stop the rain?
So if that's not the story behind it, it doesn't matter. That's what I always take out of it. But between that and songs like The Ocean from Led Zeppelin, which is an absolute homage to its audience, and talking about that feeling that you get when you're out on stage in front of a crowd, when a band can really get that across in music, I think it's a very cool thing, not only for them to do, it's a neat kind of a piece of their experience that we're a part of. You know, that they can sort of write down in song, but it also gives us something to, you know, to sort of pump our fists with in concert. So I, for whatever reason, that song, Who'll Stop the Rain, always kind of said that to me, even though what the real story is behind it, like I said, I'm not exactly sure of. I love it when they acknowledge the fact that they are what they are to us, you know?
Well, I mean, first of all, as the dude said, far fucking out. You know, I mean, this is Creedence, you know? John Fogerty may be the most cantankerous and crotchety son of a bitch that ever lived, certainly in the music world. But, you know, I love Creedence. Creedence is one of those bands that if you don't love them, you don't love rock and roll.
Right.
Pure and simple. And we're talking about straightforward rock and roll because there is no bullshit about that band had no French dressing. It was all meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
You know? And my personal favorite, actually, whenever I think of the song, I actually get a little weepy. But whenever I hear it, it's even worse, is Someday Never Comes, which was their last single. But that's just me being me. I mean, that's just such a powerful song about a father abandoning his son, you know. And then it's the precursor to Cats in the Cradle, actually. And it came out before Cats in the Cradle anyhow. But nevertheless... you know, Creedence is Creedence, and they had a way with words and a way with connecting with the audience.
Right.
Now, when you talk about a song that is the homage to an audience, there's only one band that will come to my mind without question, fail, or hesitancy. You wanted the best, and you got the best, the hottest band in the world, Kiss.
Yeah.
Because how many songs did Kiss do that were directly to and for the audience?
Right.
You know, they tried it first with Let Me Go Rock and Roll, which is a terrible song from a terrible album, Hotter Than Hell. But then the next album came the song that I think is indeed the national anthem of rock and roll. You show us everything you got. You keep on dancing and the room gets hot. You drive us wild.
We'll drive you crazy.
In a nutshell. But then they took it one step further and one step better on the next album. The album that I've always considered their revolver, Destroyer, Shout It Out Loud.
Mm-hmm.
That is we the band, you the audience.
Another band that I think has that sort of vibe, certainly in concert, although unfortunately because of several factors, we're going to see less and less of that, is AC/DC. And I can't think of a title that's directly relatable back to that audience experience, but man, do they keep that energy level going throughout an entire show. It's great.
Let There Be Rock.
Yes. And For Those About to Rock.
For Those About to Rock is a later on kind of audience, band back to the audience kind
right.
of thing.
Right.
Because For Those About to Rock, we salute you. But Let There Be Rock is the call to arms.
Black man have the blues. No one knew that.
actually is another anthemic song, even though it's not intended to. Two of them, actually. They're not intended. Well, of course, We Will Rock You. All Right Now by Free.
Yes.
And The Boys Are Back in Town.
Thin Lizzy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are those songs that you pointed out quite rightly that are direct connections between stage and seats. But then there are the covert songs that will say, hey, we're coming back. You know, here we are. Theme from the Monkees.
Yeah, right.
I'm walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. We may be coming to your town.
Right.
You know, it's, you know, there are those theme songs. Hell, even Public Image by Public Image Limited, their first single.
as much as announcing themselves. Right. And Lydon would hate you pointing that out, but you're absolutely accurate.
Lydon has surprised me in life, you know?
Yeah.
And I will always stand up for Lydon and champion him. I don't think he has ever offended me once, because I've always seen his side of things.
Right.
You know, he took a lot of shit for doing a commercial for butter in England, or one of his songs being used to sell butter in England. And he said, hey, I need to make a living.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to go away from music here for just a second and back to the movies, because I think it was Helen Mirren who was in Caligula. And somebody asked her, you know, here you are, you're this established actress, and you know, you had already won awards, and you had tremendous respect for your Shakespearean stuff from everybody that you know. Why would you do Caligula? And her answer was, well, there was this lovely little plot of land in Scotland, you see, and it needed a house on it. So yeah, that's it. You know, you got to do what you do to make a living.
For anybody who would ask her that question, did you fuckers ever look at her back then? Are you fucking retarded?
Yeah, right. All the way through to Mosquito Coast, man. Oof. Through to now, hell.
Helen Mirren is a fucking goddess.
Yep.
Are you kidding me? Fucking Nimrods. Whoever you are, I hope you get genital warts.
There you go. We're going to leave.
Fuck upon you.
What a perfect way to end the show with genital warts. So we'll do that.
We are the gift that keeps on giving. We are oral. That's AU, oral herpes, folks.
Excellent. Well, Rob Ross, we'll look forward to some more of it next week. Thank you so much again. And we'll talk to you then, brother. Have a good week and stay cool.
All right, brother. You too.
We'll see you.